each week on From the Vault, we typically start off with a clip of audio from the week's subject, all the while the theme music plays as a bed underneath. But this week we're going to do things a little bit different, because there's a particular song... Here, wait, let's stop the theme music. There's a particular song that goes so well with our subject, Lord Bertrand Russell.
Tell me true, tell me why was Jesus crucified? Was it for this that Daddy died? Was it you? Was it me? Did I watch too much TV? Is that a hint of accusation in your eyes?
I appeal to you, citizens of America, as a person concerned with liberty and social justice. When we consider that the fantastic sums of money spent on armament are awarded in contracts to the industries on whose boards of directors sit the generals who demand the weapons, we can see that the military and large industry have formed an interlocking alliance for their own benefit.
What have we done? Maggie, what have we done? What have we done to England?
What did happen to the post-war dream? Lord Bertrand Russell, the famed logician, philosopher, essayist, Nobel Prize winner for literature, activist, social critic, and spirited anti-war and anti-nuclear protester, asked that question continuously from around 1949 until his death in 1970. Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives and executive producer of From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives' weekly program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. Lord Bertrand Russell was born at Ravenscroft, Wales, on May 18, 1872. 2 years later, his mother and sister would die of diphtheria, and then not 2 years after that, his father died from illness. Bertrand Russell's grandparents took he and his brother in, only to have his grandfather pass away 2 years after that. Lord Russell's grandmother raised him throughout his childhood.
What follows is a selection made from Lord Russell's part in talks between himself and John Chandos, which took place on the 11th and 12th of April, 1961, at his house in North Wales. John Chandos speaks first.
The scene of our talks was Lord Russell's study. The climate was mildly cool. A fire burned on the hearth. The French windows stood open, overlooking a great panoramic view of Cardigan Bay. During the ensuing 2 days, climatic conditions varied from sunshine and blue skies to torrential rainfall, so that sometimes the background of sounds to our conversation were birdsong, the lowing of cattle, and the voices of my host's grandchildren at play in the garden. At other times, the gutters could be heard in flood above the veranda. At intervals, the sound of a railway train in motion and its warning whistle floated to us across the bay with uncanny clarity. Lord Russell began by talking of his early childhood, when he lived in the house of his paternal grandfather, Lord John Russell, the statesman who had perhaps averted a revolution and preserved the monarchy in early Victorian England by steering through Parliament the Great Reform Bill of 1832, 5 years before the accession to the throne of Queen Victoria.
Well, I was only 6 years old when my grandfather died, and... I didn't, of course, know very much, really, about him. I have recollections of him as a very, very kindly old man. I used sometimes to play about all around when he was in the room, and never once did he suggest that I should make less noise. Well, since I've become a grandfather myself, I consider that a merit.
Bertrand Russell began to reveal his tastes and talents at an early age. Encouraged by his brother, the second Earl Russell, he embarked upon what was to be a lifelong love affair with mathematics before the age of puberty.
I remember them very well. Euclid was an intense delight to me. I was 11 years old. And I thought, this is lovely stuff.
Although incredibly bright from such a young age, he was not educated as a child in the traditional sense.
I wasn't sent to school. I was educated by tutors. So I didn't have a conventional education. I think the conventional education at public schools was extremely narrow, because the essence of a public school education was to enable you to administer a world inhabited by savages or underlings of some kind. And it no doubt gave you the air of command that enabled you to put your thing through, but it didn't enable you to have the knowledge that would have made what you were trying to put through be right.
But for Bertrand Russell, life really began at Cambridge in the 1890s.
I found Cambridge quite delightful, unbelievably delightful. And I really began to live when I went up there. They don't live as comfortably while they are at Cambridge as they used to in my day. There'd be two people in a room, and in my day there would be only one. And they're not allowed to have food in their rooms. They have to go to hall for their food. Whereas in my day you could order anything you liked from the kitchens and have parties in your room. Dinner or whatnot. Breakfast, except on Sundays, one generally had alone. The kitchen sent out a breakfast. But on Sundays, we had a different plan. We always had a very late breakfast on Sunday and very large. We ate enormously. And then we went for a long, long walk in the country, came back just in time for dinner. And that was, I don't say everybody did that, but all my friends did. And that was Sunday ritual. Saturdays we stayed up very late discussing, arguing, and walking up and down the cloisters and arguing. And those arguments were quite delightful. They had that sort of freshness of youth exploring the world that you can only get in youth. And we used to keep them up till any hour. And that's why we breakfasted so late on Sundays.
Lord Russell came from a very privileged line. He spoke to John Chandos about his peers in England in the late 1800s and the uniformity of that clique.
The cleverer young men in my day, they mostly came from public schools. They knew perfectly well that down to the day of their death, they were fairly secure financially. They would go into the civil service, or they would become dons, or something or other like that, and their livelihood was safe, and they didn't bother. And it gave them a sort of disinterestedness that you can't get in a more straitened atmosphere. The people that I knew best were not rebels. They were mostly in favor of all sorts of reforms, but they were not rebels. They were not outside. I belong to that old world, though I've been forced into becoming more or less of a rebel, but against my temperament and upbringing and so forth. It's not my instinctive line. The young men of my day were not temperamentally cynical. Some of them, of course, had cynical opinions, but I don't think they had cynical feelings. It's quite a different thing. They all felt here is a great tradition which has existed for a long time. Cambridge had a long tradition of great men, and they thought, well, after all, we're inheriting this, we're carrying it on, and They were part of history. But I should think that some of the things that were to me delightful when I was at Cambridge are probably no longer there, because I think that people are more professional, they're more occupied with their career, and less certain of whether they can make a good career. My friends and I did, in fact, spend an enormous amount of time on the acquisition of knowledge.
Outside of the acquisition of knowledge, it seems Lord Russell was immensely shy as a young man.
Well, I did become a bit of a dandy because I was so very, very shy. And I thought, now if I'm absolutely faultlessly dressed, so that nobody can possibly find fault with me, I shall perhaps feel less shy. And I took to dressing as well as I could. I had a beautiful frock coat and lovely socks and a cane with a silver top and all the sort of things that one should have. It didn't last very long, but for a year or two I had them led.
Lord Bertrand Russell lived through both world wars and survived to see relatively peaceful time on Earth known as the Cold War. However, with the invention and use of atomic weapons, humans displayed a disturbing new ability to bring about the end of our species. Although there was no worldwide conflict raging, Russell promoted peace as a means of preserving civilization. Although his lectures describe those times from decades ago, much of what he says is equally applicable today. Here, the television host Merv Griffin interviews Lord Russell in 1963. Simply substitute the names of the occupied countries, the names of the American corporations, and their decision-makers, and we have a plausible explanation of what shapes U.S. foreign policy today.
What are the necessary steps?
Well, there are various ways of getting towards peace. Of course, the first thing would be, I think, for America to give up aggressive war, give up the habit of invading peaceful countries and torturing them. I think that's the first step.
Is that what you believe, that we are conducting aggressive wars?
You are, yes. It's not that I believe it, it's plain fact. We are conducting an aggressive war.
In Vietnam, you mean?
In Vietnam. And you're on the road to conducting a similar one in the Congo.
Aren't they more protective skirmishes?
No. Now, look, Americans, ordinary Americans, believe that they're conducting a protective war and protecting non-communists against these wicked communists. And that is not the case. It is not the case. They're conducting a war against people who were, until they were attacked, entirely in favor of neutrality.
At the time of that interview, Lord Russell was 90 years old, and his passion had not dimmed in the least, as you can hear him pounding on the table during his answer. One of the unfortunate aspects of listening to the interviews and speeches of Bertrand Russell is that the problems he discussed exist almost entirely word for word to this day. We are to learn from our history, and if we do not, we repeat it, as the saying goes. And it looks as though the United States has not learned enough from its history. Listen to what he says about the Vietnam War and the Johnson administration.
In violation of solemn international agreements signed by American presidents and ratified by the American Congress, this Johnson government has committed war crimes, crimes against humanity, and crimes against the peace. It has committed these crimes because the Johnson government exists to preserve the economic exploitation and the military domination of subject peoples by the United States industrial magnates and their military arm. The Central Intelligence Agency, which has a budget 15 times larger than all the diplomatic activity of the United States, is involved in the assassination of heads of state and plots against independent governments. This sinister activity is designed to destroy the leadership and the organization of peoples who are struggling to free themselves from the stranglehold of American economic and political domination. United States militarism is inseparable from that same predatory capitalism which reduced the American people themselves to poverty within the living memory of this generation.
The writer Theodore Schoenemann reads a quote of Russell's concerning fascism in America.
Fascism is coming to America because America has brought fascism to the war. Vietnam and Indonesia, Cuba and the Dominican Republic, Congo and Angola are the harbinger, that terrible shadow discerned by Malcolm X when he expressed the only lesson worth teaching the American people upon the death of President Kennedy, quote, "The chickens are coming home to roost."
You are listening to From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archive's weekly program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. We're spending this week with Lord Bertrand Russell. In 1963, Merv Griffin asked Bertrand Russell to explain his ideal government. His views seem to have predicted the European Union.
If we followed out your views that you've been expressing to us to their logical conclusions, what sort of a world order would you hope to see?
What I should hope to see is a world government which should of course be federal, and I think the units in the federation should not be always single states but often federations of states, because you have the problem if you have single states that the small states have an undue weight in it. The Americans had to face it in their constitution, and they did it by having two houses. But that won't quite do in this case. So I think there should be a number of confederations, and they should be the units of the World Federation. The World Federation should have the only important armed forces. The single states should only have just enough for police purposes, not enough to make any serious war. And if the World Federation had all the important engines of war, war would become impossible. I don't think anything else will prevent war, and I do think in the nuclear age, if there is war, the human race is wiped out.
In my rearview mirror, the sun's going down. Sinking behind bridges in the road. I think of all the good things that we have left. The premonitions confirm suspicions of the Holocaust to come.
In 1966, Bertrand Russell wrote An Appeal to the American Conscience regarding U.S. involvement in Vietnam. In this appeal, Russell differentiates between American leadership and the will of the American people. Bertrand Russell firmly believed in the existence of the international corporate war machine, or as we call it today, the military-industrial complex. And within the appeal, Russell compared the American Revolution to the war in Vietnam. And his comparison could easily be used to describe the war in Iraq today.
In the American Revolutionary War against foreign troops, Americans fought in fields and forests, although they were in rags, and the occupying army was the strongest of the day. Americans fought the occupier, although they were hungry and poor, and they fought them house by house. In that war of liberation, the American revolutionaries were called terrorists, and the colonial power was the one labeling them rebels and rabble. American national heroes responded with words such as Nathan Hale's and Patrick Henry's. The sentiment, "Give me liberty or give me death," inspired their struggle, just as it inspires the Vietnamese resistance to United States aggression and occupation. I have no doubt that the American people would respond just as the Vietnamese have responded if the United States were invaded and subjected to the atrocities and tortures which the United States Army and government have inflicted on the Vietnamese.
Russell felt strongly that a critical mass of Americans opposed to war to be the world's best hope for the survival of human civilization.
Abraham Lincoln gave expression to the hope that a people once aroused can be deceived no longer. All Americans who know from their own experience and from that of their closest relatives what has been done in Vietnam should come forward now. Speak the truth and take your stand alongside your brothers throughout the world. Struggle for an America free of murderous production, free of war criminals, free of exploitation, and free of the hatred of subject peoples. These peoples look to the ordinary people of the United States to understand their plight and to answer their struggles with an American resistance capable of making the United States again a citadel of individual liberty and social justice.
Today we have the World Tribunal on Iraq, which acknowledges the Russell Tribunal as its model. Although largely ignored in the United States, the WTI spearheads international prosecution of war crimes and violations of international laws surrounding the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Bertrand Russell began a war tribunal looking into U.S. war crimes in Vietnam.
I have called on intellectuals and eminent independent men and women from all parts of the world to join in an international war crimes tribunal, which will hear evidence concerning the crimes of the United States government in Vietnam. You will remember that Germans were considered guilty if they acquiesced in and accepted the crimes of their government. Nobody considered it a sufficient excuse for Germans to say that they knew about the gas chambers and the concentration camps, the torture and the mutilation, but were unable to stop it. I appeal to you as a human being to human beings. Remember your humanity and your own self-respect.
If not war, then what? Not only was Bertrand Russell against war, but he offered us his ideas on how our civilization could become something better. He envisioned a world in which humans would carry on without any desire to kill one another. Russell did not view this as an unattainable dream, but as an evolution in human nature fundamentally necessary for the survival of our species.
We need new ways of thinking and new ways of feeling. Both. Feeling just as much as thinking. We need to learn to think of other human beings as potential allies and not as active enemies. We need to learn not to hate. It's a difficult lesson after all the millennia during which we have allowed our bad passions to run rampant. But we've got to learn it if we want the human race to continue. I think this is a gradual matter. I don't think we can hope that the habits of many thousand years can be changed in a moment. And I think we shall have to approach the matter slowly. And those of us who feel strongly, we'll have to learn not to be discouraged by the slowness of our success. I feel convinced that we can succeed, and I think it's only a question of going on and on, putting the case, putting it to everybody, to all and sundry at every possible occasion. And I think in that case, we shall win over mankind to allow itself to go on existing.
Where have all the Bertrand Russells gone? Today we need leaders standing up and promoting peace in an unapologetic manner. In the following excerpt, Bertrand Russell is heckled during a speech. His heckler accuses him of being a traitor.
It's a terrible thing about governments, but they will not believe the things that are necessary to believe if you're going to take sane measures to prevent this appalling Holocaust with which we are threatened. We... Oh, yes, a traitor. Yes, quite so. Well, now, look here. Who do you think is the greater traitor? The man who wishes to see some people left alive in this country, or the man who pursues a policy that means that they must all die? No. If there are any traitors, it's the people who want us to go on with this suicidal policy, not the people who want it stopped. We have to stop all war, and that is a thing that people have got to realize.
There's probably no better way to end this week's From the Vault Remix than with that quote from Lord Bertrand Russell. Russell kept speaking out about the need to end war and to end nuclear armament until his death in 1970.
Place to stay, enough to eat. Somewhere old heroes shuffle safely down the street, where you can speak out loud about your doubts and fears. And what's more, no one ever disappears. You never hear the standard issue kicking in your door. You can relax on both sides of the tracks, and maniacs don't blow holes in bandsmen by remote control. And everyone has recourse to the law, and no one kills the children anymore. No one kills the children anymore.
And so that does it for this week's From the Vault Remixed. From the Vault is a weekly program produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. For more information on this program, or to find information on how to purchase a copy of this program or any of the archived materials of Lord Bertrand Russell we used, go online at fromthevaultradio.org or call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 800-735-0230. This week's program was produced and written by Alan Carman and Christopher Sprinkle. We use music in this week's episode by Pink Floyd from the 1983 album written by Roger Waters entitled The Final Cut, A Requiem for the Postwar Dream. From the Vault, the series, is produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle. Senior producer is Mark Torres, production coordinator Edgar Toledo, outreach by Sean Dulles, accounting by Mariana Berkovich, and customer service by Arlene Chang. Special thanks to our volunteers Joseph Falasca, Karen Anonia, and Ray Bereka. If you're in the Los Angeles area and would like to volunteer on From the Vault, please go to our website and find out how. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. For more information on him, his music, and other music used within the program, please visit fromthevaultradio.org. This program was executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and myself, Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening.
Take all your overgrown infants away somewhere. Build them all.